My name is Tink Tinker, and this is our second session on American Indian theology. American Indian theology of liberation, if you will, because an Indian theology today has to be a theology of liberation, simply because Indian people are battling 500 years of colonization and conquest that has left us in very poor straits. Something I didn't say last time clearly, but what maybe I did. American Indian peoples are the poorest people in North America today. Typically, we run reservation unemployment rates of anywhere from 40 to 92%. They're chronic rates, and nationwide we run a 60% unemployment rate. Disease seems to affect Indian people in ways it doesn't affect others, or with greater intensity. For instance, diabetes runs about six times the national norm. Some people estimate that 50% of Indian adults have diabetes, usually adult onset diabetes. Heart disease strikes about seven times as often as it does in the general population. And the longevity statistics of Indian people have Indian people dying about 20 years sooner than the general North American population. So you can see we're dealing with not only poverty and colonization, but the results of poverty and colonization as well. I did mention to you, I know that about half of Indian adults nationwide seem to suffer from alcohol addiction or in various stages of recovery from alcohol addiction. It's roughly equivalent to the unemployment rate. Not that they're connected, but they are connected structurally, even if there's not a direct proportion. So, given that sort of struggle, our theology has to be a liberation theology. In the midst of the pain and the struggle, Indian people have been working for 25 years now to recover their cultures, languages, ceremonial life, and the like, so that there's been a renaissance of Indian ceremonial life, traditional life, a renaissance of culture and language as well. When I was home this summer, I saw the most Osages dancing in the Alonska that I've ever seen. There were 300 men fully initiated into Alonska who were dancing, and 150 or so women dancing in support. It's the biggest Alonska spring ceremonial that I've ever seen. Well, I thought it might be good today if we got into talking about a particular aspect of this theology that might be useful to all of you. It has to do pretty explicitly with the fact that I was on garbage detail this morning, and has implicitly to do with environmental issues in general in the United States, and the notion of Indian environmental concern, which seems to be but in the air, a common notion that Indians have a greater concern for the environment than other Americans do. Which one might question if one's ever been to a reservation and seen 15 wrecked automobiles parked around somebody's home in various states of rust and decay. But there's a reason for that. People keep those old vehicles for parts. and also for storage, because they can use the trunks of those cars, even inside of them, to store things. But they'll keep them also for parts. If you're driving a Ford and don't have one on your lot, your neighbor may have one. And if you need a fuel pump, you might be able to find one that will work. So if you're poor, you become innovative, but it means the immediate aesthetics of your surroundings may be less than gorgeous. I thought such was the case with Holden Village when I went up and saw those old park vehicles up there, and then discovered this morning that that we pack recyclable trash into those things and store them for hauling out. I guess I want to say that in order to make sense out of what I'm going to do with us today, we have to understand that the environmental issues we're dealing with are systemic. They're systemic and are not unrelated to issues of justice in the world, apart from environmental justice. That in fact, the environmental issues that we'll be talking about are implicitly interconnected with human rights abuses in Argentina, in Guatemala, in Honduras, the civil wars we've seen the past 10 or 15 years in Nicaragua, El Salvador, and the upheaval that we've seen recently in Haiti, and we'll even throw in Rwanda and Burundi as well. Two quick stories or examples. In 1992, early in the year, before when was Clinton elected, in 92? I can lose track.
That sounds right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Took office in January of 93.
Yeah, right. So in February of 92, I was in Nairobi with a group called the Ecumenical Association of Third World Theologians, one of five U.S. delegates to the Fifth General Assembly of EITWAT. They weight the other continents over against North America because of North America's political prominence in the world. Europe has no representatives, so they're largely African, Asian, and Latin American. As I sat through the plenary discussions, became clear to me that George Bush was the favorite whipping boy of all of these third world theologians. Miguez Bonino was there, some of you know Bonino. Some of the other big Latin American names, everybody knows the Latin American names better than they know the African or Asian names. So about the second day in the middle of the day, I got to a microphone and I suggested that we were making a mistake in identifying George Bush as the enemy. I said to them, George Bush is not your enemy. I said, in fact, in 9 months or so, we're going to get rid of George and elect somebody else. And y'all's lives isn't going to be any better. No matter what your hopes are for Bill Clinton, your life's not going to be any better. Here we are now a couple years down the pike, and I think I've been proven correct. In other words, for Indian people, it doesn't really matter whether there's a Democrat or a Republican in office. Life doesn't seem to get much better on the reservation. Justice is not served, whether we're dealing with a Democratic good guy like Jimmy Carter or a hard-egg Republican like George Bush. There's something systemic involved. that means we've got to do more than just elect the right person president. Does that make some sense so far? So getting rid of Clinton, getting rid of Newt Gingrich, getting rid of Phil Gramm isn't going to do us a whole lot of good if we still have the same sort of oppressive, systemic state of affairs that drives the machinery of the Western world. Second example. A year ago, I was at Montreat, the Presbyterian Retreat Center in North Carolina, probably in some ways the Presbyterian, one of the Presbyterian equivalents to Holden Village, with the Presbyterian Peacemakers were meeting there that week. And I gave a plenary address and then did a couple of follow-up workshops. And in my workshops, I asked people, and I can ask you all too, how many of you faithfully recycle in your day-to-day existence? Show me. That's everyone here, right? How many of you have done it for 10 years or more? Not too bad, a few of us. I've done it for that long. Question. What difference has it made? Now, I'm not going to stop recycling, folks, but what difference has our recycling energy made in the world today? The truth is, in the last 10 years in the United States, we generated more waste than we did in the first 210 years. Of the existence of the United States as a republic. Isn't that astounding? Isn't that a miserable statistic? In spite of our recycling, we're running out of landfill places because we have simply filled them up. Well, I want to suggest that no matter how faithful I am at recycling, it's not going to change that statistic. That there's something systemic that we have to get at politically in a radical, radical way if we're really going to make a difference. And it's not disconnected with the kinds of warfare, killing, oppression, that has been experienced by two-thirds world people in the South. Because the same engine that generates all our trash also generates oppression in the South, because that engine can't work unless it's generating ever greater wealth. And you can't generate wealth in one part of the world without generating poverty somewhere else. Wealth gets generated on the backs of someone else's labor. So that if wealth is economic surpluses, we have generated the opposite of economic surpluses in other parts of the world. So that's really the foundation for what I want to say about Indian notions of the way the world is. I want now to say just one more thing, and that is my hope is that we can turn some things around systemically, beginning with our churches, first of all in a spiritual way that will make a difference in the world. And I think American Indians have some spiritual insights. In spite of our own poverty, and in spite of our own dysfunctionality, some insights that may be helpful to white brothers and sisters in the world in creating this systemic transformation that will have to happen. That's something. Still there.
something? You want some water?
No, it'll be fine. It'll blank out eventually. Thank you. Last time, remember, I drew us a circle and suggested that it was kind of the quintessential symbol of Indian people, of most Indian peoples. Most of us work with some form of a circular symbol. And it symbolizes not just the wholeness of the tribe, or of the family, or of the clan, but the wholeness of the world, of all of creation. It is, in fact, when it's inscribed with a cross, symbolizing the four directions. It's symbolic of all of the created realm, the two-leggeds, four-leggeds, the wingeds, and the living, moving things. And remember, the living, moving things of the trees and the mountains and the rivers and the fish and the snakes and all of those things, too. So that all of that is included in the Sioux prayer, Mitakyo Yasin, for all my relations. The prayer that ends all prayers and the prayer that a person will speak in a circle who has no words of her or his own to speak. You pray at least that much for all my relations. Mitakyo Yasin. Or Mitakyo Yasin. That's what this prayer encompasses. The wholeness of the world. In order to understand that, we've got to go back and say again that Indian people are fundamentally spatial in the way they see the world and not temporal. I hinted at that last time, but didn't actually say it. It's not to say that Indians have no sense of time. In fact, this whole notion of Indian time is a bit of a nasty racist stereotype. You know, Indian meetings, for instance, always begin on time and end on time. I don't know if you've been to an Indian meeting, but when everybody gets there, we begin. And when everybody's done, we end. That sounds like on time to me. It's not to say Indians have no sense of time, but it's to say that in the structure of the mind, that spatial categories are the primary, the principal categories, the ordinary categories, whereas time is the subordinate category, one of the subordinate categories. And that gets just reversed in European culture. European culture is a heavily temporal society where time is the primary category, and space is secondary. Let's see if I can give you some examples of that. You know, we all have time-saving devices in our homes. We know that the sacred in America is measured temporally on the seventh day, that sacred 59 minutes every week, rather than spatially. But you can see it in philosophical treatment as well. In Book 11 of the Confessions, Augustine, for instance, spends a whole chapter talking about, you know, the philosophical description of time, where he's talking about short times and long times, and, you know, short vowels and long vowels in Latin. And there are philosophers ever since who have reflected on the meaning of time. But precious few European or American philosophers have reflected on the meaning of space or place in the world. For instance, in Hegel's philosophy of history, remember the schema that we all learned in college? That history is a progression, a linear progression that involves a thesis which meets up with an antithesis which results in a new synthesis which immediately becomes the new thesis. And again, there's an antithesis to that thesis and another synthesis which becomes the new thesis. that sort of Trinitarian advance of history makes history a temporal kind of discipline. And there are those who think that history did not exist before the 19th century in Europe, that other people didn't have history in that sense at all. Memories of the past, yes, but not histories in the modern sense. That's really a temporal exercise. And then the 20th century example of that would be Heidegger in his book Being in Time. Academicians laugh when I suggest that he should have written the book Being in Space instead of Being in Time. The Indian world is just the opposite. Everything is predicated on place. We want to know where we are from. You know, where each other is from. What tribe are we from? What land are we from? More important than time to us are spatial arrangements, so that even when time seems to be important, like a solstice ceremony or an equinox ceremony, we're really talking about spatial configurations. We're talking about the spatial configurations of the relationship between sun and earth, for instance, that dictate when certain ceremonies happen. We're talking about cycles of time rather than linear time, even when we talk about time. But more important than that is where the ceremony will take place, because it can't just take place anywhere. We look for places that have special power, special prominence, a special reason to be in a particular place. People here from South Dakota? Anybody visited Bear Butte in South Dakota? It's a mountain out in the middle of nowhere. Out in the middle of the plains, there's suddenly a big rock of a mountain sticking up. It was sacred to many tribes, and tribes gathered there always in peace. If you were Cheyenne or Sioux or Crow, it didn't matter. You could camp there knowing that you would not be attacked at Bear Butte. It was so sacred. First time I went up there, I took a friend of mine with me, a medicine man from the Shichangu Reservation, Brules, over at Rosebud. He'd never been there. 65 years old, he'd never been to Bear Butte. It's what, 150 miles, maybe? Native American Theological Association, a bunch of Indian clergy, for whom this medicine man had become a spiritual advisor a few years ago. So we decided to take him to Bear Butte, and he said, we'll climb and we'll have a prayer ceremony on top, full of pipe. So we got there, middle of July, must have been 100 degrees in July. It's always 100 degrees in that part of South Dakota. And we started climbing. And I tried to stay with my friend because I felt responsible for him, and he's an old man, right? I couldn't. I was the second person up on the mountain, and he must have been 10 minutes ahead of me. I could barely wait to get up, and it's a long climb. What is it? 1,500 feet elevation?
It's steep. It's
yeah, I know it is steep. Very steep. And about 1,500 feet, I think. Had our prayer ceremony. It's a wonderful ceremony marked by the coming of an eagle that I thought was going to land on my head. It was so close. It just flew right over the top of us and screamed at us while the medicine man was praying, holding his pipe up to the sky. And when it was over, and it really was special to be there, could see some of the not being a medicine person, not being tuned into everything they're tuned into, I could even see the specialness of this place and feel it, sense it around me. But I was getting thirsty because it was hot. And it's now a couple hours since we started at the bottom. So I hooked up with Elmer because I knew he was a fast walker, maybe 65, but I'm no dummy. So I hooked up with Elmer. I said, I'll walk down with you. He said, okay. And before long, everyone else had left. And I said, Elmer, we better head down. So he said, okay. So we started off down the trail. Got about 100 yards. And he stopped. He said, oh, I said, I'm tired. Let's sit down for a bit. And I bet we stopped every 100 yards. Point is, this is sacred space, and he wasn't ready to leave it yet. So it was another hour going downhill before we were to the back of that pickup truck where our cooler of pops was, sitting in all that ice. Space is important, and spatial configurations in ways that are no longer for Western peoples. How many of you come from congregations that would consider themselves high church? No? Maybe? Mm-hmm. Well, let me ask all of you, what direction is the altar in your church? What direction does it lie?
North.
North?
North.
East?
East.
East.
It's east.
East?
East. Can't even tell.
South.
South? Anybody else remember?
It's not in the middle south, where it should be, but it's one end or the other.
That's right. It almost doesn't matter anymore where you build a church or how you build it. Knock down an old Safeway and build a new Lutheran church there, right? Anymore, there are three, I'm told by the Synod Office in Colorado, three criteria for picking a site. Location, location, and location. But by that, they don't mean find a sacred spot. What they mean is, we got to get away from the old Lutheran proclivity of building the churches off the main street where our own can find them and get out on a main corner where we can be visible to the larger community, right? So knock down an old Safeway. It's an ideal spot for building a Lutheran church. The old church, tear it down, put up a Texaco station. It doesn't matter because the site, after all, isn't sacred. It's what we do there in that 59 minutes once a week that's really sacred and really important. Used to be different. The earliest churches were built, actually, many of them were built on old pagan, Greco-Roman temple sites. Because the Greco-Romans knew where the places of power were. They'd already found them. And if they weren't using a temple, we'd build a church there because it's a place of power. That's not what the Spanish did when they built their churches in the southwest on old Kiva sites. They were simply trying to ruin those sites from being sacred anymore to the Indians so that they would convert from their Indian religion to Christianity. But in the earliest days, Christians also knew places were sacred. And also knew that directions counted. So that in the earliest But we've come a long ways from those spatial days of early Christianity into the temporal world that depends upon time in order for the economy to work. Without time, without production schedules, without time cards and clocks to punch in and out of, you don't know how much your product is worth and don't know how to price it in the economy. And there's no way to make sure that you're going to maximize economic surpluses in your corporation. So that without time and temporality, the whole military-industrial complex collapses in on itself. So time and capitalism is a necessity. It's not a necessity, however, in Christianity. We have just made it so. So in the Indian world, things are still very, very spatial. And it doesn't matter whether you're talking about a purification ceremony was done in a round lodge with an opening to the east, perhaps an altar to the east, and a fire pit where we heat those rocks. And then there'll be a place in the middle where we can bring rocks in and pile them up in that pit. It's important that the ceremony is done in a circle. It's important that the opening is to the east, unless you're a contrary, a yoga, then your altar opens to the west because you're an opposite person. And these days, Lakotas all think they're opposite people, so their sweat lodges open to the west, but only their sweat lodges. I can never understand it. Sundance Harbor, same thing, opens to the east, the trees in the center. There's a place for the dancers on the west, and the altar's set here on the west. It's terribly important that you understand that configuration and know what it means that if you add a sundance, this becomes an impermeable barrier. During the 4 days of the sundance, once the tree goes up until the tree comes down, one doesn't cross the path from the tree that goes east towards the rising of the sun. In an Osage village, remember I said last time, that there's a road through the middle of the village that goes from east to west. A famous ordained Episcopalian, turned ethnographer in the 1880s by the name of James Owen Dorsey, wrote a very important piece for the American Bureau of Ethnography called Sioux and Sociology, in which he described Osage and related tribes, villages. And he visited, he not only described them, he visited the villages, he learned the language, he had a minimal dictionary of the languages. He spent enough time in the communities to actually get to know a little bit about what was going on. But in his drawing of an Osage village, he has the road going north to south. Go figure, huh? Go figure. It didn't seem important to him. Well, for an Osage, it's really important that this road is the path of the sun that divides the village into two, into the Huncas and the Tsishos, the earth people and the sky people. Really critical for us that happens. Hence, likewise, there are sacred places all over North America. Places that are known places of power, like Bear Butte. They might be mountain places, They might be the confluence of rivers. They might be lakes. For Taos Pueblo, it's Blue Lake. In 1904, Blue Lake was taken away, summarily taken away from Taos. In Teddy Roosevelt's desire to create national forests. Admirable in itself. We all look back on that act as being an act of foresight and wisdom on Roosevelt's part. But the National Forest included Blue Lake, which is, in fact, the place of emergence for Taos peoples. And they have an annual ceremony that nobody evidently knew about, except Taos. Even to this day, the ceremony is closed to outsiders. It is so sacred and so important to them that it's closed to outsiders. They fought for 60 some odd years to regain Blue Lake, like the Sioux, turning down vast sums of money, insisting that they would rather have Blue Lake. They were even assured by the Department of Interior that they would always have access to Blue Lake, even though they didn't own it. And the Taos people said, no, that word is as good as the next administration.
True.
Or you might decide to build a road up there and put a campground on the other side of the lake from where we do our ceremony. We can't have that. We want the lake back. And strangely enough, talk about Republican and Democrat sensitivities. It was Richard Nixon that signed the bill that gave Taos back Blue Lake in 1970. I really think that the spatial orientation of Indian people has much to commend itself to others who share North America with us. That if we can come back to some sense of the sacredness of place, we'd be a long ways towards creating justice in the world. Echo justice, but not just echo justice, but human justice as well, both. You can see it right away in terms of eco-justice. If places are sacred, we're going to be much more careful about where we think about building bombing ranges, nuclear test sites, and all of that, let alone, toxic dump sites, etc. Yes,
sir.
Yeah, interrupt me at any time.
Does, for example, the BIA have a map or a series of maps that would show where Indian sacred sites are located?
No, up until this point, the BIA hasn't been interested. For instance, this is a major problem. For instance, in Arizona, the Apache peoples at San Carlos have claimed for some time now that a certain mountain, Mount Graham, it's called in Arizona in terms, is sacred to them. Well, in the past 10 years, there have been plans, starting with the Vatican Observatory and the University of Arizona, to build an observatory with 7 telescopes, one of them a 200-inch reflective telescope on top of Mount Graham, which would destroy its sacredness for the San Carlos Apache. Not only has the government sided with the university and the Vatican, but they've actually now nearly completed construction of the first observatory, although it's now
in remission because there's a restraining order. But there were some pretty obscene arguments on the part of government and on the part of Vatican that in fact this was not a sacred site to the San Carlos Apache. In part, they could argue that because the San Carlos had never been public about having ceremonies there. They'd always done it privately. Individuals had used it. You know, key medicine people had used it. Medicine gatherers had used it. Well, if we're not public and often in our usage of a sacred site, does that mean it's not sacred? Taos go to Blue Lake once a year only. Once a year. That doesn't mean it's not sacred. In fact, it's the place of emergence. But in the mind of the U.S. courts, that's not very sacred if you only go there once a year. And besides that, you don't own this mountain. It's U.S. Forest Service. Well, you know, Indians didn't have that understanding of land when they were moved on to the reservation. So that was kind of a difficulty for the Indians at that point. And they continued using Mount Graham, but nobody had noticed. Nobody had noticed, and hence it must not be real. So that the San Carlos Apache have been accused, their medicine people, their elders, their old people have been accused of lying in order to stop the building of this observatory. See, the real sad thing is that the church is involved in that through the Vatican. The church is doing this. Why does the Vatican need an observatory in Arizona? Why does the Vatican need an observatory? Or, to push it even a little further, why does anyone anymore need a land-based observatory since the Hubble was fixed? You know, all of that's antiquated. But they're going to do it anyway. And one wonders if they're not doing it simply to exacerbate Indian people, or simply to destroy Indian attachments to former religions. Because most of the St. Carlos are now Catholic. They're Catholic and they do both. The church would rather they just went to church. So the other thing I want to deal with today, having dealt now with spatiality, is something else I hinted at last time, and that's reciprocation.
Indian respect for the wholeness of the world is such that nothing in the world, essentially nothing, can be changed without a ceremony of some kind. You don't cut down a tree or kill a buffalo or build a ceremony lodge without a ceremony. There's got to be some way to reciprocate for everything that we do. It is as if nothing can be done that doesn't affect others in the world, and hence somehow you have to adjust for the effect that what you do will have on others. Others meaning not just two-leggeds, but four-leggeds, wingeds, and living, moving things as well. Now, it's clear to Indian people that you've got to violate balance and harmony in the world in order to live. The world cannot continue as a static entity without moving, which is ultimately what it is, but without eating and drinking, we all will die. So there's a ceremony for everything. Whether you are hunting or going to war against a neighboring tribe, whether you are picking medicines or picking food or planting, there's a ceremony for everything. When we, a group of us, Living Waters Ministry, the Lutheran ministry that I'm pastor of and that is benefited by the sale of these books, went to the state of Colorado about 8 years ago and began to negotiate the building of purification lodges at each of the prisons where there are Indian inmates. And eventually we got the permission to build them. We had to deal with chaplains first of all and educate the chaplains and the wardens and educate them. Hey, Tim. And eventually we got permission to do it. Then we had to go in and build a lodge in each of the prisons. A major undertaking. We started with six. There must be 10 or 11 sweat lodges now in state prison facilities in Colorado. And like the states you all come from, Colorado is pretty sure that it's more important to spend money on building prisons than on helping people with welfare. Bruce said the other day, if we cut back on welfare, there's going to be a price to pay down the line in the prison system. So we're getting ready for it in Colorado. We're building new prisons every year. But as we went into each of those prisons, see, our concern was that Indian people in prison have only one hope of breaking the cycle of recidivism, of repeat offenses, and that is to become integrated into their own self-affirming spirituality, tribal spirituality. That Christian churches in prisons in particular don't work for Indian people. So we had a couple of Sundancers help us, went in and built these lodges. Beginning then already, we had to teach inmates who may have never been a part of their own spirituality before. Teach them how to build a lodge, because you may have to rebuild this lodge someday. So, you know, we had to bring in the willows, right? We couldn't take them out to cut them, we had to bring them in. Had to bring in the rocks. But then there's a ceremony for cutting those willows, and once you bring them in and begin to build the lodge, it's a kind of a half dome igloo-like structure made out of willows and then covered typically these days with waterproof dark tarps, in the old days with skins, with thick lightproof skins. By the time you're done, it's still going to be lightproof even today, so that it's really dark inside. So we went around to each, we'd dig a little hole in a circle all the way around for 16 of these willows. And it's important that we took a little tobacco and we put it in that hole with a prayer each time, so that we are making an offering back to the earth. We're reciprocating for the life of those willows. We offered tobacco when we cut the willows. At Living Waters, we used to go out and cut a Christmas tree each Advent. And before we would cut the tree that we wanted to bring back to our church, we'd sing to that tree and pray to it and offer it a pipe. And everybody with us would take a little tobacco and offer that tobacco back to that tree, reciprocating for the life of the tree. Because when you cut that tree down, you're perpetrating an act of violence. Now you're in a sense violating the sacred by taking another life. It's true when you pick corn. Even though you planted the corn, it has its own life. And you're violating the sacred when you take that life away from the mature corn plant. So there has to be a reciprocation even then. An offering, perhaps. A song, a prayer. Offering typically would be, for many tribes, an offering of tobacco, of native tobaccos. So only then am I free to pick the corn or to pick the sage or the cedar for medicines or to begin to cut down a tree, especially a Sundance tree. We did the same thing with our Christmas tree. We would have a young child who is still a virgin take the axe and lay the first cut in that tree. All of this is a way of saying to the tree and to the tree nation, this is our respect for you. We know you have your own life. And we're asking you now to come with us to help us with our prayers. And we know we can't cut you down without having a ceremony to give back to the tree nation, to give back to the earth for that which we are taking. Same thing happens in the hunt. In fact, the hunting ceremony is virtually identical in Osage culture to the war ceremony. You know, it starts with that. It's 11 days long. Because there are lives that are going to be lost. You have to consecrate those lives. You've got to be able to reciprocate for the lives that will be taken, whether they're Pawnee lives or Osage lives or buffalo lives, and perhaps especially buffalo lives, because we relied so heavily on the buffalo for food. And then once you've killed the buffalo, and each major Osage village needed somewhere between 40 and 60 buffaloes two or three times a year, two or three major hunts a year. So we're talking 100 buffaloes a year minimum in order to survive. Once the buffalo is down, you begin to cut up the meat and to skin it. That's not all, because virtually everything is used. There's very little waste that is left. In fact, there are certain delicacies that are eaten on the spot. Lewis and Clark talked about a group of Shoshones over here in Idaho that they ran into who were so starved that when they finally killed a deer, they fought over one another to see who got to eat the liver raw right on the spot. Well, Lewis and Clark didn't know what they were talking about. That's the best part of the deer and the best time to eat it in order to get especially some of the spiritual essence of the deer as a part of me is right when it's killed, so that the liver especially and the heart is eaten on the spot as soon as the animal is killed. True of buffalo too. But everything is used. The sinew is used. The bones are used for tools. the horns, especially the coverings of the horns, are wonderful for dipping liquids. You know, they're hollow and waterproof and great for drinking or for pouring. But everything virtually was used. I'm thinking of that because on garbage detail this morning, I was amazed at how much trash this little community generates. How much trash we think is necessary to generate in order to, and I'm as guilty as anyone else, not extolling my virtues. In fact, at one point I could tell what had come from my cabin. So that when we go to get a tree for Sundance, for instance, the whole community will gather of dancers and supporters and singers, medicine men, and we'll sing and pray to that tree. Clear the area around it where the tree is going to come down. And then offer a pipe to that tree. And one of the medicine men will offer a pipe to the tree. And they'll bring that young one forward. Quite often a young girl, usually a girl, in fact. And she'll take the first swing at the tree. A girl around 9 or 10, usually, or a boy, if there's not a girl. And after that first blow is struck by that child, and you can hear, you know, the people's sense of joy at that moment. And then one of the men will take the axe. And the first blow, of course, may not even have gotten through the bark of the tree, right? And we're talking cottonwood, so we're not talking thick bark. But a couple of blows later, you'll hit a vein in the tree, and the water will come gushing out of that tree. And you know that the tree is going to be with us for 4 days in that ceremony. So when the tree is ready to fall over, all the men will line up behind that tree where it's going to fall, because they need to catch it. I mean, our respect for the tree is such that it will not touch the ground, period, between the time it is cut down and the time it is finally laid to rest after the sun dances over. So that if it's a big tree, one year was one about this big around that we got. I was in pretty close to the trunk. I don't know how we managed to even catch the thing. It was foolish to even think of a tree that large, but we did it. You catch the trunk and you carry it, and you do set it down right before you put it in the hole that has been dug ahead of time. But you set it down not on the ground, but on a bed of sage. Fresh sage that has just been picked, a thick mat of it, is laid down for the whole tree. And we're talking a tree that's at least 100 feet high or more by the time you get to the top, 125, 150 feet sometimes, a big tree. That may be a little too high, probably 100 feet. That's the respect for this one tree. And if we have that respect for one tree, you can imagine that clear cutting a forest isn't an Indian agenda. I mean, I'm not sure there's a ceremony for clear cutting a forest. There's a story, and I'm going to use it even though a friend of mine has advised me against using it. But I find it an important story to use. And I use a very simplified version of it. It's extant, told from the Canadian East Coast all the way down to Florida and across the south as far west as Laguna and Acoma Pueblos in New Mexico. In this story, the first mother and first father had begun to build quite a family of children. And at this time, the world of two-leggeds knew no death. Their food was always four-legged. They hunted. At least first man hunted. He's the only one that was permitted to hunt. And as the family got larger and larger, first man had to go further and further away from the village in order to hunt. And pretty soon his children began to be hungry all the time because he just couldn't keep them fed. And of course, children are having children, and children are having children. The village is becoming enormous, and they're hungry, they're starving to death, but they know no death. It got so bad, the first mother was given over to crying all the time. The first man was touched by her tears so much that he pleaded with her again and again, "What can I do to stop your tears?" And finally, one day, she told him, "This is what you have to do. You have to kill me and take my body out to that clearing and drag it around the clearing 7 times until all the flesh has fallen off of my bones and all of my blood is soaked into the earth. And then bury my bones in the middle of that clearing." Well, first man couldn't do that. And this is his wife. So first woman's tears continued day after day, week after week. And finally, first man decided to take a trip to the north, to Klaus Kerber, his uncle, who had created them. So he headed for the north. And of course, you have to allow for the fact that the story doesn't deal with how people are fed while he's on this journey. And the journey is 4 days getting there because he stops every night in the lodge of a relative. Deer, coyote, badger, elk. Each night he stops in the lodge of one of these relatives and he tells the whole story to them. So that if you're hearing this told traditionally, you'd hear what I just told you 4 more times. And finally, he gets directions each time and a little help from badger woman, from coyote old man, from deer woman, from elk. Finally, he gets to Klaus Kerbach and he tells the story again to Klaus Kerbach. And his uncle says to him, "Just what he didn't want to hear, what your wife has told you is right. This is what you must do. You must kill her. Drag her body around that clearing 7 times till all of her blood soaks into the ground, all of her flesh falls off her bones, and then bury her bones there in the middle. That's what you have to do, and then your children will eat." So now it's Klaus Kerbe's turn to cry. And he cries all the way home. And arrives in the village that day with tears streaming down his face. And first woman knows what he has decided to do. And her tears stop at that moment. So first man and his sons take the woman out to the clearing. Kill her, they drag her body around the clearing 7 times, they bury her bones in the middle, and wailing and weeping because they had never known death before, they go back to the village and spend the night wailing and weeping, and the next morning still crying and wailing, They come out of their lodges and go out to the clearing to pay their respects to their mother, his wife, one more time. Only the clearing has been consumed. These tall, leafy, green plants growing, handfuls of fruit, yellow and white, blue and red. We have corn in four colors. And they fought their way through this forest of corn to the middle, where they found the grave where they had buried her body, and there was growing all sorts of squash and spinach and onions and beans and chilies and all the other vegetables that are eaten by people today yet. And this green leafy plant right in the middle. And there was a voice then that came to them and said, all of this is my flesh. Comes from me, your mother. And she gave them then directions how to save some of the seed from each planting so they could replant it and have plenty always. And then gave them instructions on how to cut and dry the leafy plant in the middle. She said, it's called tobacco. And if you use it carefully, it will help you in your prayers. And to this day, you see Indian people smoking like a steam engine, but you don't find them chain smoking. And so finish that cigarette. They even have respect for that cigarette that's killing them until it's done, and they'll put it out. See, this story is a story about the sacredness of the earth. Because First Mother from then on is Corn Mother, and Corn Mother is the earth. So that we know that everything that grows from the earth that we eat comes from that First Mother, the one we call Grandmother. We know that even when we kill a deer to eat it, that its life has been fed on the things that grow too, so that we can say that that deer and even we ourselves come from the earth. Hence, we have to be careful how we walk on the earth. We have to be careful how we take our food. We have to be careful that we don't disrupt the balance of all of creation, but have to work, commit ourselves to participating with the Creator to maintain the harmony and balance of the whole. And so we have to reciprocate for everything that we take. There's a ceremony for that. Coyote said. I want to stop there and get you all involved more in the conversation. And Sherwins have agreed to maybe even get started there.
Well, first I'd like to know, why are you not supposed to tell that story?
It was an Indian colleague who fears that non-Indians hear the story and take the story and miss the point. Again, it's a misappropriation, ethical concern. That's his concern. I think that story is a useful story for making the points that I'm making.
Don't you think, though, that the whole respect for the earth and the honoring of space, the honoring of all our brothers and sisters in all the different nations, is constantly supported and underlined and emphasized by the ceremonies that you do, all of your ceremonies?
Mm-hmm.
It seems that our ceremonies have so much of the time element in them, and I don't mean in how long they're supposed to be, but our prayers are often about events rather than things or places. Our Eucharistic prayer is all about events rather than the things that are actually being used and honored in that ceremony. And I wonder if that lack right now, that little piece that's missing, might subconsciously form us to be separate from the things around us.
You made the point yesterday in conversation, or the day before, that even the Eucharistic prayers that we tend to use, the ones in the Green Book, are all oriented towards history, towards temporality and time. And they're oriented towards that rather than towards space, to the world around us. You know, you're the God who has brought us salvation through history. Well, salvation through history is nice. That's a little bit too German for me. You know, that's von Rothen-Bultmann stuff. How about salvation right here in this place with all of these things around us? And when will we extend God's salvation to the trees and deer of Holden Village? See, for God so loved the world, and every commentary on John you read will tell you that by cosmos, what John meant to say was human beings. For God so loved the human beings of the world that he gave his only begotten Son. Hey, what? That's a little short-sighted for me, because my world includes a lot more relatives than just human beings.
Although Paul in Colossians, it's in Romans, talks about all creation.
Groaning in travail.
Yes.
Romans 8. Groaning in travail. Do you all know what that travail is? The verb is tiktao. The pain associated with childbirth. Now, all of creation is not in some sort of torture imposed on it by human beings. I mean, Paul wasn't thinking about the modern ecological crisis, but he had creation involved actually in the act of salvation itself. Groaning in travail, in the pain of childbirth, waiting to give birth to something new in the world. I suspect that's still possible, but we got a lot to do to make sure it continues to be possible.
You know, I wonder if this is the Hebraic and Christian scriptures themselves that tend to reduce salvation to people, or if it's been our interpretation of it. I wonder if humankind is what the fourth evangelist meant by cosmos. I wonder when the fourth evangelist talks about Jesus being lifted up on the cross in order to draw all things to himself. I mean, we translated that all people or all men even sometimes.
Yes.
I wonder if it's been our reading that's been the problem, and if there isn't another reading of some of those passages. Ephesians is very clear that it seems to me that it's the whole household of God. It's really the whole created order that's being mended and saved. There's a thin line, anyway, in the Christian tradition that maybe it's time to paint red so that it shows up a little more brightly in the whole narrative.
See, the New Testament isn't always explicit in including all of creation in the world. But then it didn't imagine that there would be a people who wouldn't do that.
Mm-hmm.
The Greco-Roman patron, the head of an estate, especially in Roman legal parlance, had responsibility, for instance, for the doctoring of all the people on his plantation. So it might be a senator, probably is a senator from Rome, somebody like Cicero or Seneca. They're responsible to know all there is to know about modern medicine in the first century BC or the first century AD, because the health and well-being of all of their servants depends upon them. That's a whole lot different. I'm not extolling the virtues of Greco-Roman slavery, but that's a whole lot different from North American slavery in the 17th, 18th, 19th centuries. That patron is also responsible for the well-being of all the livestock, for everything on the plantation. Well, God so loved the world is patron language, because the patron also is supposed to be a loving person, a caring person. Not loving in the sense of phileo, but loving in the sense of agapao or agape. Acting in the best interests of all of your estate. And not all of your estate in capitalist financial terms, but all of your estate in terms of humanitarian caring terms. Yeah, I agree, Susan. I think that it's our reading of Scripture that gets us in trouble. Our reading of dominion in Genesis 1 has caused so much problem. Instead of dominion, read that in the sense of the patron too, as the one who has responsibility, not to use up, but to take care of. See, we've read it in the sense of freedom to use up to our own pleasure. We're no longer caretakers, but abusers of the earth. And it's not just you and me. It's not just George Bush. It's the systemic whole that means all of us are part of it. We can't escape being a part of it. I was appalled going through the garbage and seeing my own garbage there. Ashamed.
It's too bad all villagers don't get to do garble at once, because it's true. It's true. I keep coming back to, for those of you that weren't here at the other time, where I had once said to Tink that I'm so envious of so many of the Native American traditions and some of these that he described here with space. And his comment to me was, well, so much has been lost. Because I said, I know I can't have it because I'm not Native American. And that was his response, so much has been lost. And I was struck with that again when you were describing the spatial setting for the sweat lodge and it facing the east. And I had a class in a master's program I was a part of on ancient Israel, and learned how many of those kinds of things were just part of the early Israelite life. Ritual places and sacred spaces, even the place where Moses, the burning bush, that was already known as a sacred place for people had gotten revelations of various kinds, usually from the Canaanite practice. And so it just struck me how that is a part of our past, of our Judaic and now Christian tradition that goes way back. And we've really lost all these things. And they make sense to me, and we underestimate the sense of sacred space right now. And I think we trod upon it with this, especially in the 60s, with the whole notion of centrum as opposed to worship space, where you have a multi-purpose room instead of a space that's set aside for a special act, a special gathering. Because I think we have lost a sense of energy of a space over time that is used for something in particular.
And that really struck me once when we had Eucharist. Susan, you were there in Philadelphia. When we had Eucharist in that 300 or 400-year-old church with the vessels that had been used for 300 or 400 years, it was like, I get tingles now remembering it. There's an energy that's not there when it's a place that we just sort of, we tear the fuse down and set up tables for lunch, and it's different. It's a whole different thing. And even facing east makes sense, especially if we can see the rising sun, as we call ourselves Easter people, and a play on words with rising sun and worship on Sunday mornings. And there's just so much that I can learn from hearing this again in the Native American tradition.
Well, it was being in Germany in 1973-74 that won me back to Christianity. I was ready to leave the church over cynicism and anger, Vietnam War, civil rights, wounded knee. I was ready to leave the church. And I went to Germany to begin PhD studies in New Testament. God only knows why. I think I went just to be in Germany because it sounded like a thing to do. And being in the churches there, the old churches, is why it wasn't the German people that won me back to Christianity. It was those old churches. And the sense that you can feel, the saints of 1,000 years in some of those buildings. And it didn't matter whether we were talking about Carolinian basilicas or Romanesque cathedrals or the later Gothic structures. They were just awe-inspiring places, and they touched something Indian deep inside of me. That made it possible for me to continue being a Christian.
I have a question about how you reconcile for yourself and for the people you serve in your congregation. How do you reconcile both the Christian and the Native? And my question comes from experience that I had spending Christmas at Taos. And Elmer and I went out on Christmas Eve and watched the procession of the Virgin Mary around that Taos Pueblo, if you've ever been there at that time, which was, emerged about 4:30 from the temple, and then it was this procession honoring the Virgin Mary. The following day, on Christmas Day, we were there for the deer dance, which was their one of their winter ceremonial dances, which they allowed people to come and see. And those two, in two separate days, different orientations, but one following the other. How does that become integrated, or how does that sort? Or am I trying to be too linear and too Western? You've been asking this question.
The Pueblos have their own way of doing that. The Pueblos have, each Pueblo is different because there are four different cultures or language groups even among the Pueblos. But they distinguish between those who relate to traditional religion and those who relate to the church. So in the Tewa groups, for instance, the fiscales are those who are appointed to coordinate between the church and the village, the church and the pueblo, so that there is more of a differentiation than is apparent to the casual observer. But all those people might go to church still, even the medicine person or the chief who is totally disempowered in church might be there. And on the next day, the fiscales have no power. And suddenly, these other functionaries take on ritual and ceremonial authority in the community. Indian people have a long, long history of borrowing from one another. And borrowing from someone else something of spiritual power, that's a given. We just do that. And if Jesus happens to be that, we're interested. Ohiesa tells a story. This is Charles Eastman, Dr. Charles Eastman, who grew up not speaking English in a Santee village. Tells the story of the first missionaries that came to his village. And the missionary wanted to tell the people the story of salvation. So he's invited into a lodge with all the elders. And he told the elders the story of salvation, beginning with creation in Genesis, all the way to the death and resurrection of Jesus. And Indian sat for a long time. This wasn't a simple sermon. This was a long time. And when he was done and sat down, one of the elders stood up and began to recite the Dakota version of the creation of the world and how the world got to be the way it is and how it is that we have been told by the Creator to live with one another. And he hadn't gotten very far along when the missionary stood up and said, I came telling you the truth, and now you want to entertain me with these fairy tales? And so the Indian man sat down. Another Indian man stood up, elder, and said, it seems to us that you don't understand, and this is Ohiesa's words now in English, you don't understand the fundamentals of civility. We listened very patiently while you told us your story, and now you won't listen to ours. See, the thought was not in the Indian minds to hear something we can do instead. The thought was, well, if this has any value, we can include it in what we do. Which is a different notion than European missionaries came with.
But it doesn't have to be either or kind of thing.
Right. In my congregation, it's a little more difficult because my congregation is made up of political activists who are less likely to concede my Christianity. They'll concede it to me, but not to themselves. So that when I say Holy Communion, typically a quarter to a half of my congregation will refuse communion. And I have, you know, I've got to deal with that. I can't tell them, you have to do this. I mean, they come because they like my preaching. They come because they can pray. And they'll stand very patiently after we've prayed. What we do typically is consecrate communion. And then when Christ is present on the altar, then we'll have our prayers. That's the moment of power for some of us, is when the elements are consecrated, not before. And they'll pray. But then when they're done praying and we share bread and we're so many in recovery that it's bread and grape juice. It's a Lutheran heresy. Not in the ALC, but for the rest of us. They'll refuse. And there's a youth Sundancer who will take the bread, but not the grape juice, because he says, I'm youth. We cannot refuse bread. Because bread is sacred to them. They can't turn down bread. They must eat it if it's offered to them.